Okay, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to give a talk here. So Yaroslav worked on me quite strongly, as you can imagine. No one really wants to do this voluntarily. And I should also say he instructed me very precisely what the level should be of the talk. And I hope there are a few people in here who are not working in H-bar physics, because my talk will be for you. If you are in geophysics, you are the target audience. And everyone else, I have to apologize. I mean, it's impossible to really make the balance. But I assume you all have good food. So if you get bored, please eat. Good. This program, as you know, is on spintronics. Spintronics is a notion coming from spin and electronics, and combines the two things, and it's a very, very vast, broad field. And I want to talk now a little bit about the ultimate H-bar aspect, Planck's constant aspect of spintronics, which is connected to quantum computing. And I understand that I should give here now a one-hour lecture on quantum mechanics, because that's the basis of quantum computing, and then on quantum computing, and then on condensed matter, how to implement quantum computing, and I aim at doing this in this hour. So, actually I should stop up there. I want to start with 101 crash course on quantum mechanics. And so maybe you might find this funny, how I want to define quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics essentially, I would say, is the theory of superposition. Superposition of states. Now, what does it mean? I will use symbols. So there are two types of superposition. One most likely you have heard of is if you have a one-particle system. Let's call this one particle superposition, and we denote this by a state. We describe this one particle by such a symbol here. It doesn't really matter what it means, it's just a symbol describing the state. And that symbol is composed of two contributions. Let's say I consider now a particle like an electron which possesses a spin 1/2, can either be up or down. These are the two possible states this electron can have. And in quantum mechanics, we can have superpositions of this type. We can make it a little bit more general and allow here for phases or so. But what it means is that we have kind of a simultaneous representation of a state or of the system being in the up and in the down state. And that's something which is very non-classical at first sight. But if you look at it, it also is connected to some wave properties. I mean, it's connected to particle wave duality. And in principle, you could also have this with classical waves. For example, with light waves, you can also have superposition principle. But still, this is one of the fundamentals of quantum mechanics. And the extension of that is really unique to quantum mechanics. If you go beyond one particle, if you add now two particles, three, four, and so forth, and you form superposition out of those system states. So here, if I have an n particle superposition, I write now a very peculiar one, or particular one, again, use this symbol here. And instead of one arrow, I use now n of those and write the superposition of this state. So if n is a large number, in the ultimate limit, sometimes you would like to have n being a very large number, for example, macroscopically large number, that this would be a totally amazing state if one could get something like this here. It's so amazing that it has actually a special name. Sometimes it's called the cat state. And why is it called cat state? Because Schrödinger, when he designed quantum mechanics in 1935, noticed this paradox that quantum mechanics could lead to superposition of macroscopic systems, so macroscopically distinct states. And for this, he devised the Gedanken experiment for a cat, which is locked into a box together with a deadly device consisting of an atom which can decay. And the quantum mechanics predicts a certain supposition of decay or not decay, and this translates then into the dead or alive cat state. And so that basically could then be identified that you call this state here corresponding to the alive state and this state to the dead state of the cat. And this shows how paradox quantum mechanics can be when you drive it up to the macroscopic scale, that you can have a supposition of such vastly different states. Vastly different means they are different by macroscopic degrees of freedom different. Good. Now all these states, they are nice, but very hard to observe. So directly you cannot observe them. Quantum mechanics forbids that, but you can do measurement. Whenever you do a measurement, you go either in this state or in this state or in this state, but you cannot measure directly simultaneously both as a supposition. So you have to do then something in sequence and then find consequences of that state. A state like this here, you know, I call it here an n-particle supposition, is referred to as an entangled state. And entanglement is very important in quantum mechanics and is also at the heart of quantum computation, because that's exactly what you would like to generate, states of that type, and exploit properties such states have. And I will show in a moment what kind of properties they could have. Let me just make a side remark here that the states of this type here, cat states, they have been realized for systems n equals 3, 4. And you see, you can win Nobel Prizes when you go to 3 or 4. The ultimate goal, of course, would be, you know, to be a little bit bigger. There are some systems, magnetic particles, where experiments have been done. It's by now almost 20 years ago, David Ashwalom, collaborators in ferritin, where a supposition of essentially 10 to 4 was found, some signals of that related to that. But this is also one of the very interesting questions in this field. How far can you drive quantum mechanics up the macroscopic scale? And then ultimately, let's say if you had a quantum computer available, I will explain it later what a quantum computer is, it's supposed to generate states maybe like this here, and then we could also test physics. We could drive up the physics to a macroscopic scale, and just add one after the other, and see whether such macroscopic quantum states can be really realized in nature. This is still, from an experimental point of view, actually an open question. Good. So, this is 101 on quantum mechanics. Good. Now, 101 on quantum computing. Well, here's the abbreviation. Basically, we are now in business. We know what supposition is. And I just say that the unit we want to use is a bit. A bit, as you know, in classical context, can, for example, be a number 0 or 1. And a quantum bit takes now both in a supposition as a possibility, like I have written down over there. And this we call here a qubit. And a qubit can now be any quantum system, or I should say any quantum two-level system. And physics, we just write two levels there. Let's say in general not determinate, so energy difference, for example, I can have a spin up and a spin down in a magnetic field or so. And as you can imagine now in physics, there are many, many systems which are represented at least in some low energy sector as a two-level system. You could also have higher levels here or lower levels here, but you can pick out two and call this your quantum bit. And 15 years ago or so, actually 16 years ago was the first workshop in quantum computing here at the KITP. There was a flurry of proposals based just on the idea, search for a two-level system which you could control to some degree and use it as a bit, as a quantum bit. Okay, so in the end, again, what you want, the supposition I write now here, 0 and 1, It's the same as this arrow up and down. And the natural candidate for this is the spin of an electron, as I mentioned before. Because the spin of an electron has been studied since the beginning of quantum mechanics, and it's a very obvious object. I think it's probably first proposed by Feynman to look at that as a potential candidate for a good two-level system. And this connects us then to a spintronics program. So it's the first connection. We will use this then more and more. And quantum computation, so just the quantum computation procedure can be summarized, or at least I do it, like this, in three steps. So first, the first step consists of preparation. We need to prepare your system in a given state. It's like initialization. You know, have a computer, you want to initialize it in a, you know, prepare in a given state. And we do this with n qubits. And this is what we can call the input of the calculation. So again, for example, the electron spins, I have n of them, and I prepare them now all to be up. Of course, I have many possibilities, but I say now this is my input state. For example, I apply a strong magnetic field and all my electrons are happy, go into the ground state and point upwards, and this is a input state. This also, incidentally, is a so-called product state. I also used that before. We can also write it more precisely as a product of states which live all in their own space. Then we write it like this. So this is the representation of the spin of particle 1 and that of particle n. And there is no correlation or entanglement in such a product state. Good. And then the second step is the calculation. And the calculation is you just apply a so-called unitary transformation, let's call this U, to this state. And then I get something which I call here just the output. So this here essentially is the input, and I apply a unitary transformation on this input, I get an output, that's a calculation. What is a unitary transformation? Unitary transformation is a special object which changes my spins here, puts them into a superposition. And a very important property of a unitary transformation is that it is time reversible. That means I can go backwards and forwards. And that's also a hallmark of quantum mechanics compared to classical or quantum computing compared to classical computing. In a classical computer, you can only go forward in time. So it's not reversible. But here in a quantum computer, ideally, we can go back and forth. That's what unitary here means with this operation. And then the third step is measurement. Measure the output so that you know the result. And again, this is a non-trivial step because if you have superpositions of this here, then it will be thrown in one or the other state. And you have to do a clever type of output preparation in order to see then a result which gives you the gives you directly the result of the calculation. Okay, this sounds now a little bit mystic, but in principle, each step must be considered separately. Probably the easiest one, once you have defined what a qubit is preparation. Not always. Sometimes it's difficult to prepare your system in a physical environment. Sometimes it's easy. The unitary transformation is probably the hardest. So to do this operation on your system. And before we go to this discussion in more detail and then come to physics, let me say why quantum mechanics could actually be or could provide a way to calculate faster than classical. This goes back now to the entanglement, in the sense that entanglement generates some sort of parallelism, which is very special to quantum mechanics. So, for example, if I have a state which is after this operation, unitary operation, go from a product state into a entangled state of the following form. I write it now with one, this one coefficient. So I have n states here, n bits. Or quantum bits and allow now for all variations, I can have combinations of states. So let's example, you know, the next state could be a state 1, 1, 1, and the last one I flip up to 0, and I go through a combination where I flip all of them once, and I get this state. And I go through this, now I can do it with 2, and, you know, go through all possibilities, distribute zeros here. And as you can imagine, it's a very, I mean, there are always coefficients, some arbitrary coefficients. I go through, and the possibilities I have are 2 to the power n, because each state here can assume value 0 or 1, and I have n of them, multiply them, so I get 2 to the power n in general state suppositions I can look at. And just to give you a number example, if n is 266, then I get 10 to 80. You can check that. And this is, when I checked the last time, the number of atoms in the universe. Maybe changed by now, I don't know, you tell me.
No, we know that.
I don't know, I just, you know, there's some dark matter which I didn't include here.
What are you using atoms?
Atoms, yeah. So, you know, if you view now an atom as an equivalent of a computer, then this tells you, you know, I have here a huge number of input states all together in one state. And the art now of quantum algorithms, quantum computing, is to take advantage of this superposition, of this kind of potential parallelism. And so from this, I could argue that quantum computing could be faster than a classical computer. So the emphasis here is on could. So potentially. And the problem now is to find problems and algorithms which indeed work faster, which can fully take advantage of this supposition present in quantum mechanics. And that's a highly non-trivial task by itself. So this is then, you know, a field which is now a field by its own, quantum algorithms. And just to give you 2 examples which made quantum computing kind of mainstream, is that quantum computing can be sometimes faster. And there are 2 examples. The most famous one is the so-called Shor algorithm, which solves the following problem. If you have a number, 15, and you want to factorize this into its prime factors, then this is a unique operation. So I speak very slowly, maybe you have figured it out what it is. So it's 3 times 5. You can check it very quickly, but it's harder to find it out. So it's some sieve procedure to get it. So if I give you now another example, I really have to check if I know this or no. So what is this? You know, how many prime factors? What are the prime factors? And I see some of you have already gotten it. So it's 13 times 17. Again, 2 prime numbers. And now you can imagine, if I increase the number of digits here, I go up, let's say, to 300. I get a huge number. And this number can also be factorized if it's not a prime number. And that is then a key. So if I know that, I have a key. And this is used in RSA encryption. So all information, essentially, secret information, uses this type of procedure. So the time to solve that problem, given this number, and prime factorize it, grows exponentially with the number of digits. So it's an exponential increase, or in computer language, that means it's a hard problem. And a quantum computer, so this is now classical. So what we did here, you know, when we think we do classical, like a classical computer, but a quantum computer, that's an algorithm designed by Shor, can do this task now exponentially faster. So instead of a classical time, calculational time, which would go with the exponential n, so n, let's say, is the number of digits I have here, short algorithm, the quantum computer could do this in a time which, let's say, some representation goes with n cubed or n squared. So then you see this increase here, even if the prefactor might be large, at some point you will win. At some point you will beat a classical computer, and it doesn't really take a lot of input bits. So typically around 200 or 300 digits, a quantum computer, if available, could solve this problem, you know, which takes a classical computer, the age of the universe, 15 billion years, in a few hours, or 20 hours, 30 hours or so. And this has caused a lot of excitement in the field, and that is the reason why there's also a lot of money going into that field from certain sites, like the army and so forth. Good, there's another algorithm which is also speed up. That's a search, data search algorithm. So if you have a data which you need to sort, then there's a speed up which goes, is the square root, not as fast as this one, but it's also interesting, is the Grover algorithm. There are many variations of that kind of algorithm, but there are very few conceptually new algorithms since this algorithm, which have this tremendous speed up and could potentially be killer applications, as one says, in this field. So it's one of the you know, challenges in that field also to find algorithms so that it's really worth building a quantum computer. Another thing you can do with a quantum computer is simulation. You can just take a quantum mechanical problem and simulate it, because the quantum computer acts like quantum mechanics directly, and could then simulate a physical process. And that is also considered to be important. Good. Okay, so a little bit an outlook what you could do. And now let's go back here. You know, what is really the problem, the challenge in a physical environment to get a quantum computer going? And why don't we have one already? I mean, people have been working in this field for the last 20 years, and there's a lot of money and research going into it, and still, you know, we are in the beginning. Why is this so? Good. So one ingredient are these quantum gates by which we do these unitary transformations. And let me give you one example. So for example, if I have a product state with free spins, and I want to map this, or I want to do an operation on that and get it into a superposition, again, let's say of this type. There are many other possibilities of superpositions, but that's the simplest one now for me to write down here. Then you see that I have to act on three particles simultaneously to get a state like this. So I want to do this, let's say, here with one operation. I act on it, and that should be my output. But this means, in other words, in physical terms, now if you think, you know, how to implement that, what are the forces acting on your system, it means in the end that you need free body forces. And this we don't have in nature. In nature, typically available are single body and two body, two particle interactions. So if I describe this here as a three particle operation, then this involves three body interaction, and this we don't have. So we have only, let's say, two body interactions. And the best I can hope for is to have a gate involving two particles at the time only. But then I run into the problem and say, okay, I have a very nice scheme over there with a huge unitary transformation, which would involve n particle at the time. Does not exist, so what do I do? And this was also a very important insight in the beginning of quantum computing, that you can decompose such a n-particle unitary transformation into a sequence of one- and two-body interactions, unitary transformations. So you can always state this as a theorem, that if you have an n-body unitary transformation, you can express it in terms of single particle than two-particle unitary transformations. So then that means, you know, this will be a product of such operations that at the time I act and only add two of them, and then and the next step add the other two of them. And so I can think of designing a sequence such that I go from this via some intermediate steps on this side, on this superposition. Okay, and then the question also arises, what are these single particle and two particle gates? And it turns out that there's a minimal set, a universal set, which does the job. Let's say you have some single particle rotations, for example, of your spin. If you want to rotate your spin from up into down, that's a gate operation, or from up into pi over 4, this is a factor of 2, so pi over 2, and pi over 8, and Hadamard operation, which is somewhat in the diagonal. Very often we describe this as a Bloch sphere, with the north pole, south pole, and now you can think of the spin as some classical vector, and I want to rotate this into a specific direction, and such a rotation corresponds then to a logical operation. For example, if I rotate it around the x-axis, this corresponds to a not operation. So I change then my input 0 into a 1 by an operation like that. So single particle, single spin operations, they are not so difficult to get. I mean, physics is full of operations to do that. Now, the two particle is a little bit harder to get, and there is one fundamental gate which emerges there. And this is the C not gate. So controlled not gate. In principle, any gate which entangles should be sufficient, but it's nice to have a controlled not gate. And the controlled not gate, I down now over there. Yaroslav also told me to be funny. But I'm sorry. Good. The C not gate has a very nice representation here. So I have an input state. It's called this A and B. Then I get the same on the other side, but here A plus B, and A and B, let's say, take the values 0 or 1. So it means that I have two bits. Now just think classically. I have two bits, input and output, and I do an operation here. And that's the symbol for the addition modulo 2. So I have 0 or 1 input, 0, 1 input here. So if it's 0, on this side I always get the same as I get here as an input, but down here it can change. So if I have a 0, nothing changed, because if I add 0 to whatever B is, I get the same. But if A is 1, then I add it, then I change. For example, if B was 0, I add 1, then the output here will be 1 and so forth. And this is called the truth table, and that's C not gate, the conditional not gate, conditional meaning depending on this input here, and that's also a classical gate. What is quantum mechanics now doing is it asks that I can do the same gate with a superposition on input. And then I get superpositions on entanglement on the other side. Okay, so the input then here from classical to quantum is that, I just instead of a 0, for example, I get some 0 vector. Input the same for 1. Okay, good. So we know now this is a gate which is useful together with the single qubit gate. If I have that, I could assemble any algorithm, and therefore I can focus now from a physics point of view, forget now all the other stuff, I focus now on this two qubit gate, and I want to understand how can I get a physical substrate to do what I want to get me this gate here. And so one of the fundamental questions then is how to implement the C0. And the answer is now here in this context for this workshop, spin. There are thousands of workshops of similar type, and you will hear something else. I mean, there are many, many other candidates, as I mentioned before, and I will not advertise them because now I focus on spin. So if someone feels left out, I'm sorry, I will focus on spin. And spin, I will also say actually why it is potentially interesting for applications. So we use now spin 1/2, and the big question now is, if you have an electron which is very tiny, you cannot just take an electron floating around. You need to confine it somewhere, and you need to confine it in such a way that it can control it, that it can measure the spin, that it can read out the spin. Now, measuring a spin 1/2 is very difficult. This is something which is now barely possible with some AFM techniques or MFRM techniques that you can detect that when you measure long enough, but it's something which is rather difficult. And so the idea now, which we are following here, is to say, okay, I have the spin of the electron to which a magnetic moment is attached, which stores the information, which is my quantum bit. But I want to manipulate and read out and everything via the charge degrees of freedom of the electron. I want to do it electrically. I don't want to do it magnetically. And one of the reasons is because that the magnetic fields are very hard to control. It's very hard to control a magnetic field on a length scale of a few angstroms or nanometers. It's hard to switch it fast on and off. With electric fields, we know how to do this. We can do this with local gates. There's an entire industry out there. They build these chips and they, you know, make the computers you use. And therefore, we aim into a direction where we have similar technology available. And that means you have to go to the charge. You have to go to the strongest forces which are available in a solid state. These are Coulomb interactions, and they allow you to speed up your problem or to have a fast high clock speed. Good. And now we also need to understand how to couple physically actually spins with each other. And so for this, I go now switch gears a little bit, go to another quantum feature, namely so-called quantum dots. Quantum dots are structures in semiconductor physics which are tailored after atoms. So basically, quantum dots can be thought of as artificial atoms. Artificial in the sense that they have sizes, diameter factor of 1,000 bigger than a natural atom. An atom has an angstrom diameter. Here we are talking about maybe 100 nanometer, 1,000 angstroms of size. So where do we get such quantum dots? Okay, now I come to the condensed matter part, crash course. It's possible to confine a sea of electrons to a two-dimensional plane. Don't ask me how to do that. It's a very complicated procedure. Here in Santa Barbara, the most famous growers which can do that, and they have done this for years, and this is a very important playground for condensed matter physics. Two-dimensional electron gases have many interesting features. And one of them is that they are two-dimensional. So the electrons, they move essentially freely in a two-dimensional plane, enclosed in some heterostructure. And you can build gates, metallic gates, on top of such a structure. So sandwich here, many things in between, but let's say there's some layer where I have a two-dimensional electron gas. And on top of it, I apply or I place metallic gates, and I put voltages on these gates. And if I do so, I repel the electrons underneath these gates out of that region. And I can do this now, not me, but my experimental colleagues, to such a high precision that they can empty this region completely and then let in one electron after the other. So that, for example, you can have a situation where you have one electron sitting here in such a quantum dot, and typically here diameter of 100 nanometer. A nanometer is 10 to minus 9 meters. So here, 10 to minus 7 meters. I think it's just about a thousandth of the width of a hair. So very fine structures, but this is a routine these days to work on a scale of 10 to 100 nanometers in these structures. And then you can do this for a bigger structure and have a second quantum dot here. So a second electron. And now you see I have gates in between which separates the structure. And such a structure I can write here a potential landscape underneath, which looks something like a double well potential. So on this side, this corresponds to this electrostatic minimum, this and this. And so here I have a spin city, and here a spin city. If the voltage of this gate here is high, then the barrier here in between is high. So the potential landscape, you can think, you know, of two valleys, and things are sitting down here, and it takes energy to go over the mountain. Quantum mechanically, it's possible not only over, but you can also go through the mountain, you can tunnel. And it's this feature which you can exploit, that this electron here talks to this electron here and forms a new state. And this new state could then be a correlated state. We call this a singlet state. So if I lower this barrier, maybe I go up here. Low here, and now I change the barrier, make it lower, and quantum mechanically we describe this as a wave function of the particle sitting here, wave function sitting here, and they have nearly no overlap. That means they don't see each other. If this barrier comes lower, then the wave function spreads and they overlap, and so they talk to each other, and what this leads to is a new level structure. These two levels are split energetically into two levels, where the ground state, now the lower state, is a so-called singlet state, where I have an upspin with a downspin. There is another feature of quantum mechanics, so-called Pauli exclusion principle, that you can put only one fermion in one state. And here we have one energy state. This is this energy level. And we have two spins available, so we have one up and down. We can put in here, and the next higher one will be an orbital representation of a singlet, two spins up here, loosely speaking. Good, and this splitting, this energy splitting, we call exchange, and that's the energy difference between these two levels. Another way to view this, this correlation here is the following. You could say an electron sitting here can once in a while tunnel on the other side. This is quantum mechanics, certain probability if there's an overlap, so you can tunnel on this side here. But when it's on this side, you pay Coulomb charging energy because you have two electrons sitting on the same side. They don't like that, costs you energy, so it goes back. This is only virtually during a very short time possible. But when it goes over, it has to go into the opposite state. And this forms the correlation between the spins. So we need ingredients which are hopping, because I have to go once and back, so it's a t squared. In between, I pay energy u, so it's t going back. And that's the exchange energy. And the exchange energy can be controlled then here by the Coulomb interaction. That's hard, so basically this is not what you do, but you can control it by this hopping amplitude. The hopping amplitude just is nothing else but saying how much the overlap here is. And this is the hopping amplitude which allows me to turn on and off this exchange. So I change this barrier height, for example, go up and down, then I turn on and off this exchange. And written down in a Hamiltonian, so you notice I switch gears now, I use some technical terms. A Hamiltonian is just the energy of your system. And here on this side, the Hamiltonian is zero, because the barrier is very high, and on this side, it has this nice form. It's an exchange interaction between spin 1 and spin 2. And this is scalar product of the three components of my spin, left and right. And it's this exchange which is now controllable through gates. And this is what I wanted to achieve. I wanted to have a fast control over turning on and off the interaction between the spins. And what I exploited, again, was Coulomb charging energy and Pauli exclusion principle. Now in a solid, that's not all. We also have relativistic effects. and to take them into account will spoil the picture a little bit. Relativistic effects, they couple spin and orbit, spin-orbit coupling. They are strongly enhanced by band structure. Good.
Daniel, with this spacing, it's sort of 1,000 angstroms. The Coulomb energy, I presume, is then down by a factor of 1,000 from 10 eV, so it's a 10 eV.
Okay, good. That's a good question. The screening is such that basically you have no decay in a scale of 100 nanometers. It depends a little bit on your structure. If it were a metal, then of course screening would be very short. It would, you know, an angstrom or so. So here it is about 100 nanometer. It's defined by the distance to the top gates from which you are separated. Energy scales are like this, that the single particle level spacing on this side here might be milli electron volts, depending on the size. And the charging energy, U, about the same. This varies a little bit on size and material. And put that in here, typically you can get from 1.1 to 1 MeV. And if you translate this then into a time scale, and this is actually what gives you the clock speed of your system, then 1 MeV or 0.1 MeV is very, very fast. You know, here we are talking about already gigahertz frequencies. Good. So now we have this energy or this Hamiltonian. What do we next? Now we use Schrödinger equation. Schrödinger equation describes the time dynamics in quantum mechanics, like the Newton equation describes dynamics, time dynamics in classical mechanics. So the Schrödinger equation tells us how a state in quantum mechanics evolves in time, given some energy landscape or given a Hamiltonian. And this allows us then to use this Hamiltonian here to express it as a time evolution process. So this is the Hamiltonian. I exponentiate it. It's just the rules of the games. And then I get the time evolution. And this I call my unitary transformation. It also happens to be unitary, which is a nice feature. And the only thing I need to know now is, when I turn on this time, how long do I need to turn on this time to get the desired gate operation? And let's say if I, in this case now, in this example, if I turn on the time such that the integral over j of t of the exchange is pi over 2. I think it's pi over 2, yeah. Then I get a very special gate or operation, which we call square root of swap operation. Sounds a little bit pompous, the name, but it just means this. I have two spins to begin with, and then this unitary transformation transforms it into an equal superposition. So I start with the product state, two spins, one, two, and end up here in an entangled state. And it's a swap operation in the following sense. If I prolong this from pi over 2 to pi, then I just swap the two states. So they are basically interacting with each other. Now I turn on the interaction, and then they start to precess around each other. You can think like classical echoes. And if I stop this precession at the right time, I will end up with the opposite configuration of swapping the two states. If I do it in half of the time cycle, then I have started with this and have ended up half with this. And then I end up in this superposition with the entangled state. Good. And now I can assemble, I can actually use this square root of swap and get the C naught. So there are two square root of swaps I need here. A single spin and another two square root of swaps. And that's it, five pulses. So I have this system, five pulses and single spin rotation, and I get the gate operation. And I can do this now, you know, based on these numbers I give you here. And these were also predictions, and then they were found in experiment. So the first experiment showing this square root of swap operation was the experiment by Charlie Marcus and Amir Jacobi at Harvard. And the switching time, so the switching time was on the order of 200 picoseconds. Picosecond is 10 to minus 12 seconds. So this is pretty fast. So here we are now in the speed range of a of a normal chip transistor processor. They also in the gigahertz range. And this is one of the reasons why this system is very attractive. One reason. There are other reasons why it's less attractive. I come to them in 5 minutes. But the fact that you can operate things very fast here potentially, and already experimentally confirmed, is very interesting. Just to tell you, after all these years, 15 years or so, where are we? The experimental state of the art is three spin qubits. Well, I should be precise. We promised 3 spin qubits by the end of the year. My experimental colleagues will be unpublished. They are there.
Each qubit is a spin?
Yeah. Each qubit is a, it depends now. So there are variations on the theme. So in one group, yes, Karucha's group, they're working with spin 1/2. And the other groups, like Amir Jacobi, uses variations of that. Instead of spin 1/2, you use singlet triplet states. And there you need then 6 quantum dots because you double the system. There are other representations which need even more quantum dots to define one qubit. So there are exchange-only qubits. Charlie Marcus has them, but not operating as qubits yet.
By the end of this year or 2014? What was promised?
This year.
Not much time left.
I'm recorded, right? Actually, the sponsor is IARPA, so they might listen, you know, real time. And I should also say there are other competitors in the field based on trapped ions, and they have about 10 qubits. What is the difference? The difference is the size. Here's a chip, you know, thousands of a hair breadth, and trapped ions, they need, you know, a room like this. And it scales super exponentially. And also the time scales here are much, much faster than in any other system. But now that's not the full story, we come to this. And there are many different spin qubits, but I think I skipped that. There are many different materials. The favorite material at the moment in research is still gallium arsenide because there's lots of knowledge known, so it's a special material where you have these two decks. But there's a very long list of different materials, I will not list them. And carbon-based diamonds, NV centers, it's growing. They all have advantages, disadvantages. Okay, what is the problem? What is the problem in physics? The problem is the following. If I have a superposition of a state like this, so these are two particles, special superposition, is this minus sign, we call this a singlet. So you might remember from your chemistry course that, for example, the ground state of a helium atom has 2 electrons in there, is a singlet. And that corresponds to 1 quantum dot with 2 spins in there, here, up and down. That's a nice state, you could say, which is also an entangled state, but it's kind of useless. And it's useless in the sense because they are sitting too close together. You need to have some individual marker to call this a qubit 1 and qubit 2. So you don't want to have a helium singlet, you want to have a hydrogen singlet. So take now 2 atoms, and the singlet gets a little bit distributed. This corresponds to our double dot system. And then in the end, it's possible to really separate them. And that means I put this here very far away, and this here on the other side. No, actually on the other side, I want to show this. And of course, this is particle 1. And they still form a singlet. This is 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. And what I want to show with this here is you can also think of this, the right end of our galaxy, and this here, the left end of our galaxy. I don't say universe, could be closed. So, and you still have an entangled state. This was one of the reasons why famous people like Einstein never subscribed to quantum mechanics, you know, because this was really kind of weird. Spooky action at the distance, it was called spukhafte Fernwirkung in German. And that is something which is really very astonishing, astonishing feature, amazing feature of entanglement. But now you see immediately the problem. You know, if you have a spin very far away, and you know, some planet comes close, it might actually disturb the spin. You are not living in an isolated space, and you know, flipping the spin doesn't cost much, and it will happen, and it will happen very fast, and then the state is gone. And this is a process which we call decoherence. So the system is never isolated. It's like saying, you know, in theory, you write down a Hamiltonian energy and you leave out all the bad terms. And then, of course, it looks all beautiful. But there are many, many more terms, usually, which I can call the environment. And the environment usually is an enemy. It's, you know, it's really nasty. It always finds ways to disturb your system. And it's also connected to the fact that if you can measure your system, you as an experimentalist, then also the environment can measure it. If the environment cannot see it, then we have no ways to measure it. So it goes hand in hand. And we always have to find a compromise between coupling to the environment and lifetime. So this is this interaction between system and environment leads to decoherence. That's the big problem, the big challenge in this field, to beat decoherence, to find systems where this decoherence is as small as possible. So it's decoherence is suppression of coherent supposition of or entanglement. And you can imagine this is actually the biggest activity in physics to study this process, because everything else here is 101. I mean, this is simple. You know, once you understood this, this you're done. But if you want to understand in a real physical system, you have 10 to 23 degrees of freedom there acting on your system. What are the main forces? How can you control them? And very often it turns out that you can understand all these forces and go into parameter space, which is optimal. It's not perfect, but it's optimal. And optimal in the following sense, that this time over which coherence can live can be made long compared to the switching time. And that's the name of the game. So we call this time, this lifetime, let's say T2 time. And very often, if you do nothing in a solid state condensed matter system, then this time is as short as the switching time. And that's very bad, because you know we have created the state and the state is gone. And this was about the, 15 years ago, most proposals for qubit level systems were on this time scale in solid state systems. Then you have systems, 10 to minus 9, a nanosecond, already better, but still not good enough. And these days in quantum dots, they come up to 10 to minus 4 seconds. So these are about 100 or 200 microseconds. And there are other systems where you can even come up to seconds. So if you go to trapped ions, you know, they tell you they have to stop the decoherence because it just goes on forever. The system is so isolated. But it also means that the switching takes a long time in that system. Anyway, so the ratio then of the switching time, tau, over there, to this T2 time is a relevant quantity. And now we are up at, as I said, at this 100 microseconds. If you compare this now with a nanosecond, then you have already a ratio which is 10 to 5, 10 to 6 or so. And that ratio is believed to be sufficient to do error correction on the system. So there are always errors. Can you correct them? Yes, if there are not, too many errors within a given time, and you can proceed. And we are in this regime here, where this ratio, as I said, is 10 to 4 or 10 to 6. Good. So now we go out into the future.
In a real device.
Yeah. So this is the device by Amir Jacobi. So the time measured, the T2 time, is 275 microseconds for a single triplet qubit. And the switching time in the same device is this 200 picoseconds. Yeah, I mean, there are, of course, you know, devices and systems where sometimes the ratio can look better. Look, I mean, I would say, so these are real numbers. I can give you the reference. I'm not making them up. And it's a lot of work to get to these times, especially in gallium arsenide because of the nuclear spins. So you have to do echoing, and it's a long story. Good. Scaling up. So once we have this scheme, now this scheme is all electrical in the sense that I can do the gate switching. I didn't tell you really how I do the single qubit gates, but believe me, they can also be done purely electrical. Basically, we exploit Rushbaugh spin orbit interaction, for example, and then you just move your electrons and the spin also rotates as it has been implemented. So the next question then is to scale up the problem. You're still following? I'm just talking to you. It's good.
I can understand that
good. You're just talking. This side, you know, I see they're bored already. Good. Scaling up. This is one of the keywords these days in the business. Because now you have to start to think of architecture, you know, how we can get it cheap and so forth. And the architecture people are thinking about these days is the so-called Kitaev surface code. So the inventor sits here. If you have any questions, ask him. And this code is a way to implement gate operations in a higher level language, so to speak. So we have kind of a lattice. And I have spins. You can think of spins here on the lattice or on the vertices. And they interact with each other in a special way. C-not gates, for example. And this interaction allows me then to introduce a new scheme. I cannot go into this scheme now, I'm sure. Alexei will be happy to explain it to you later. But what you can do is then you have a scheme available which has a very good error threshold, at least in theory. And error threshold means, you know, before I said this number 10 to 4, 10 to 6, that's about the, that's what we call an error threshold, which here can actually go up to 10 to minus 2 or 1%. And translated, you know, into more experimental language, this basically means your gates need to be precise up to 1%. A few years back, you know, they had to be precise one part in a million. And if you go to an experimentalist and tell him to turn the spin by one part in a million, precisely to pi over 2, you know, it's a hard thing. But 1%, okay, one part in 100, this is within reach. Maybe it's a little bit lower, even if it's one part in 1,000, but that certainly has caused a lot of excitement in the field and hope. Yeah, however,
if you want to actually make gates rather than just storing information, more like 10 to minus 3.
10 to minus 3, yeah. That's what I said, 1 in 1,000. But, you know, it was the same before. It was 10 to minus 6, and then you could say maybe really for physics it's 10 to minus 7. That was always an overhead. However, if I go back now to my electron spins and would like to implement this, there is one issue. The issue is, I explained you know, this coupling to you before, that required some kind of short-range coupling. But here in this system, you know, we want to have a little bit more space. We also need a lot of wires so that it is scalable. And for spin systems, the distance here should be on the order of a micrometer. If you come and say, no, it should be 10 nanometers, then this is really pushing beyond the limits. And the question then is a very fundamental question. Can we get still this exchange coupling, this fast coupling, over a distance like this? And that is a very interesting question by itself, because now we have to start to think, is it possible to create entanglement over a channel? Not any more directly coupling, but over a channel over longer distances. Jaroslav, you have to tell me the time.
Actually, it's Larson's in charge.
I'll stand up.
You said I have 2 hours.
That's funny.
Good. It's a long story. Actually, I'm half through my talk. So it's a long story. Let me cut it short. There's a paper appearing today in PRX where we describe such an entanglement via ferromagnetic gates, which leads me back to the theme of this workshop, spintronics or magnetism meets quantum computing. And one of the ideas there is that you can actually use a classical ferromagnetic bus on a scale of hundreds of nanometers or micrometers to couple. This has excited many people, because this solves now the problem, at least on paper, solves the problem for scaling up the system. There was another topic, so this would, I really love to talk about that, but let's see. I'm pushing the limits. And maybe a last remark, just leading over to some very active area of research, at least as far as I'm concerned, is the study of quantum dots. So I told you, that you can create quantum dots with these gates, confinement. One of the challenges, experimental challenges, is to have only one and one electron in the dot. And it took actually almost 20 years to achieve that. It's very difficult. And you always have to fight with that, can you scale that? And so another question is, can we actually get a system which by itself gives us only one and one electron in the system? And yes, the answer is yes. The key word is, if you look at system which allow for so-called Tom-Shockley bound states. So if I have a, just as an example, a one-dimensional wire, and apply here some periodic modulation in the wire, then you will get end states. And these end states, they form, they are bound states decaying here, and they contain only one electron, just by design. There are not more levels in there, just one electron. And it turns out that they have also very interesting statistics, very interesting properties. So for example, here in this system, you find that they are fractional fermions. You can extend in that system. So these are quantum particles with very exotic statistics. And they have also caused interest because they could lead to gate operations which are better protected than the one I described over there. This runs under the name of topological quantum computing. So where you try actually to do things in a way which is very insensitive to the path from A to B. Just, you just have to go from A to B. And this forms also a basis for that. So we see now there is actually kind of a very interesting connection to that. From fractional fermions, you go to Majorana fermions. From Majorana fermions, you go to para fermions. And from them, you go to Fibonacci anions. And these are Q spins. And this is my proposal now. The next workshop will be Q spintronics. And we talk then about bound states or quantum dots containing Fibonacci anions. Okay, so I think with this outlook, I'm at the end. Thank you very much.
Question.
Now you want to smoke.
What is a Fibonacci anion?
I wish I knew. Okay, so a Fibonacci anion is an anion which has non-abelian properties. So if I take them and exchange them, I get a phase matrix. So not only phases change, but I get a phase matrix. And this phase matrix is such that when I use them to do this exchange, it's called braiding, I can end up with gates forming complete universal set. So it's the smallest universal non-abelian annual node. Now, a more precise definition is if you take two of them and you fuse them, then they go into itself or into the identity back into the vacuum. But that's a more formal definition.
Sure. Do you think we're going to see quantum computing anytime within the next 20 years?
Is there a young person here? Yeah, maybe one of the young people. You know, I always get this question. Do you know what you eat at the end of this week?
Kind of rough, I think.
Yeah, you see. So I have a rough idea. I would say like this, it's unavoidable. It's unavoidable because it's quantum mechanics and we believe that this is the most fundamental theory we have, you know, in this energy range we are living. And that's the best processing we have available. So I think it will come. Whether it comes now during my lifetime or the lifetime of some young person here or even beyond that, this I don't know. But we see progress. The progress is slow. So for example, with these spin qubits, you know, actually I'm very proud to say, 16 years ago, we had this workshop here and this started 16 years ago. But I'm not so proud to say that we have come only to 3 qubits. But you know, other fields have grown faster, but it's also known that once, you know, the physical principle is understood, the mechanism, and industry gets interested, that means, you know, many engineers sit on the problem, it could go fast. But it's very difficult to predict that. At the moment, I say there is no roadblock. It's just a challenge, but it's not a roadblock. It will come.
So there's the computing part, there's the spin part, and the tronic part. Is it the gates? Is it so more like the experimental part?
Well, I mean, you know, spin tronics has been coined 10 years ago or so. And what it means is you have spin and electronics. Electronics means, you know, currents, you move your electrons around. And before, it focused just on charge transport. Now we also focus on spin transport. So spintronics means that you move around your spins. And here, you know, everything is connected. So you move your spins, you bring them closer and further apart. That's a loose definition. That's part of the field.
This is a strange question to be asking for Santa Barbarian here. But do we really deeply understand the physics that has allowed that improvement in the ratio of the people here at the time?
I mean, this is an extremely difficult question because I would say it really depends very specifically on the system I'm looking at. Very, very specific. I don't think there is a generic notion of decoherence. It's just something which acts on your system, but it can do this in many different ways, in many different disguises.
But we don't have enough understanding to say, well, look, if we looked at that atom rather than this atom, then maybe it would be better.
So now you're asking a principal question whether we should believe quantum mechanics.
No. I just want a predictive theory.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Okay. I mean, maybe I was a little bit modest. I mean, you know, basically, this theory is based, many things are based on real theoretical models and calculations with predictions. And most of them have been observed and verified experimentally. So, you know, we predicted all these time scales, we predicted the window where to go. And this is, I think, is very important.
Well, how did David Asherman, I've asked him this before, how did he know to look for these specific spintronic systems?
Okay, I mean, let's say the quantum dot business was around, you know, when you were here at this workshop 15, 16 years ago, people worked on quantum dots, they just wanted to trap charges and study Coulomb blockade effects in these systems. And for me, it was kind of a natural system to think of looking for qubit physics in there. Now, David Asherman has looked at many different systems. So for his work was very important, at least for us at that time, to show that in a semiconductor, gallium arsenide, measured by light, by Faraday experiments, that the lifetime or the T2 time can be 100 or 150 nanoseconds. And that was a surprise at that time. Because, you know, all time scales they were believed to be in the lower nano or picosecond range. And all of a sudden there was a system where you could see, you know, a extension of factor 100 or 1,000. And I think that caused a lot of, kind of excitement and hope. And then people went to quantum dots, and the first measurements of quantum dot spins, lifetimes, they were very, very disappointing to the experimentalists because they were nanoseconds or even less. But then we said, look, just read our paper, we said that they will be so short. And there's a specific reason. Gallium arsenide has the nuclear spins in there, and if you do nothing, you just see 2 nanoseconds. However, this is this is what we call defacing, and this defacing you can undo by echo. And now we have learned many, many techniques to deal with the nuclear spins. So you can prepare the system, you can narrow the nuclear spin distribution, and those lifetimes have shut up now. They have gone from 5 nanoseconds to these 275 microseconds. You know, it's incredible. Within, I would say, 6-7 years. And in the beginning, people would say, no, it's impossible to go to times like this. So, I would say we have not reached yet the limit. So in these systems, from theory, you understand you should be able to go up to milliseconds. But now it's okay. You know, if you have switching times of a few hundred picoseconds a few hundred microseconds, the window is good enough. So now the focus is more on scaling to get more and more systems. And there will be new problems, of course, but.
Thank you.